I'm Jordan.
And I'm Rosanna.
And on this podcast, we explore how to take life off autopilot
and relentlessly pursue a life worth living together. Welcome to Season 2, Episode 3 of the Relentless Pursuit Podcast. This one's titled Considering Minimalism. So in addition to talking about carpool and back to school and all of the other things that parents talk about, one of the ideas that you and I continue to examine and kind of explore is our relationship to objects.
Mm-hmm.
I think
so many objects.
So many objects, so little time. I think one of the ways that I defined you as I wrote your bio for our webpage was that I called you a minimalist.
Right, which I thought was a bit erroneous, maybe a bit exaggerated. Like I don't feel attached to objects, but I think in my mind, minimalist is something that is a little bit more extreme.
So you're thinking a minimalist is like someone who has like a tiny house, like 400 square feet and has one shirt and one pair of pants.
Exactly.
So I did. That's how I characterized you, because you're not a things and stuff person. You don't like to accumulate things. You don't attach like value to objects. You're mm-hmm. not like the guy who wants a fancy car or expensive watches or like right. Those things just don't hold value for you.
Well, I wouldn't mind having those things either. But I feel like I think even despite that we do have so many objects. And I do feel like that it preoccupies our time and attention, even though I think there's a lot of practicality and necessity to those. So it's worth examining, like, how many we have, how many is worthwhile, what is the purpose, and what's our relationship to those things.
Okay. Well, in America, there's this belief that kind of permeates our culture, and that belief is that material possessions improve an individual's personal and social well-being. And I think that's, you know, like, if you think about the American dream, right? Like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. A lot of people would say that the pursuit of happiness is the pursuit of obtaining more things.
Mm-hmm.
So contrary to this belief, multiple studies show that materialists, and we'll define those as people who excessively are concerned with material possessions, have lower social and personal well-being.
Mm.
So
it's the opposite.
Correct. So sometimes the more stuff you have, kind of lowers your social and personal well-being.
So it doesn't even not make you happier. It actually makes you feel worse.
Correct. So when I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about minimalism and materialism, all I could think of was the movie Fight Club. And it's not like that's one of my favorite movie, right? So far we've quoted what, like The Godfather and Fight Club, but
all these modern philosophers. All right, let's hear from the philosopher Tyler Durden.
There you go, Tyler Durden. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy crap we don't need. We are consumers. We're the byproducts of a lifestyle obsessions. The things that we own end up owning you.
Yeah, I like when he says, you are not your khaki pants.
Yeah, you are not your white shirt, right? Yeah. If materialists have lower social and personal well-being, what's the solution to finding more balance, more happiness, more contentment, and better overall well-being? Some are saying that it's the notion of minimalism.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a look at what that means. You might have heard the term before and you're not sure what it is. Minimalism is the notion of living with less for the sake of your mental and physical well-beings. Experts say that living with less helps people be free of financial worry, get rid of clutter that does not add value to your life,
mm-hmm.
and allows people to focus more on experiences rather than objects.
Mm-hmm. And we had the opportunity to talk to an expert about minimalism and kind of how that, and just exploring that concept with her. And so in today's episode, we're going to present you in a few moments with an interview, with a conversation that we had with Casey Lloyd, who I just want to tell you a little bit more about. Casey Lloyd is a positive psychologist and coach who has worked with the young, the old, and everyone in between. Her various professional roles have included psychologist, school counselor, group therapist, and caseworker. Casey hails from Queensland, Australia. She's a member of the Australian Psychological Society and is an accredited coach with Growth Coaching International. She received her bachelor's from James Cook University and a Master of Science in Applied Positive Psychology and Coaching Psychology from the University of East London. and she works in partnership with multiple organizations, facilitating coaching, consulting, and workshops with schools and other businesses and institutions. And Casey has done a great deal of research and most recently has published some of this original research about the topic of minimalism in the International Journal of Applied Positive Psychology. So we enjoyed our conversation that we had with her, and I feel like not only learned a lot from her, but she helped us just understand and I think articulate a little bit more about just how we should think about our own, like you said, mental and physical well-being and how that intersects with, for better or worse, with the objects in our lives.
Yeah, it was interesting to talk to her about materialism, minimalism, and overall well-being.
Exactly.
Not really focusing on happiness, but well-being, what's best for our mental and physical health.
That's right. So in this interview, we hope you enjoy. You'll hear us ask her a bunch of questions and to stick around afterwards for some of the takeaways that Rosanna and I had from that conversation.
Welcome to the show, Casey. It's nice to have you here with us on the Relentless Pursuit podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We wanted to just kick off and ask you to tell us a little bit about positive psychology and how that led you to begin taking a look at minimalism.
Okay, so I guess the best way to describe positive psychology is to think about what we know about traditional psychology. So traditional psychology looks at fixing what's broken, I guess, is the layman's way of describing it. So we go to a psychologist when we're anxious or depressed or struggling. And what positive psychology is it's more of a, I see it more as a proactive rather than a reactive approach. So it can be used in conjunction with traditional psychology therapies, and it can, you know, assist with mental health issues and the like. But what it actually does, I think most importantly, is it buffers against mental illness. So positive psychology is about, it's the scientific study of optimal human functioning and what makes life worth living. So rather than looking at kind of deficits and problems, it looks at strengths and potential and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a relatively new field in psychology. So it's about 20 years old now. And yeah, it's just, I think when I came across it, I was working as a school counselor and I was doing, I got to do a coaching accreditation program and I came across positive psychology during that. And I was just like, this is the piece of the puzzle that's missing, that I, you know, there's so many people that don't fit traditional mental health diagnoses. Like they don't have depression, they don't have anxiety, but they're not exactly living their best life. Mm-hmm. So they're functioning, they're getting through the day, but they're not flourishing. So that's where positive psychology, instead of, God, I could talk about this all day, but if you look at like well-being on a continuum where zero is functioning, you know, minus 10 is severely depressed and 10 is like living your ultimate best life ever. Traditional psychology kind of gets you from, you know, down this end of the scale from minus 5 to 0, 1 or 2, whereas positive psychology wants to take you from there all the way up to 8, 9 or 10. So does that answer the question with that?
I think that's great. One of the reasons we started the podcast, it was part of it was to do something together, but we wanted to do something positive that made a difference. And really the kind of the tagline for our podcast is taking life off autopilot and relentlessly pursuing a life worth living together. So talking about this, like life worth living, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that look like? And how do we take like good to great? And that's really what like kind of excites us. And so, you know, those are the topics we're looking at, that like, yeah, life is good and life is okay, but maybe the prescribed narrative for people isn't making them fulfilled. And so how can we talk about things that get people to kind of think about their life, their intentionality with what they're doing, and move them from good to great? Mm-hmm.
It's positive psychology. Yeah.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
There you go. You'll go down a rabbit hole later looking at positive psychology websites and books and research. Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, that's what it is.
just as a bit of an aside, like that reminds me of, like, we get a lot of advertisements for like coaching, like life coaches, or sometimes they're specific to certain industries or niches, like a real estate coach. Like, how would you equate positive psychology to like the coaching industry?
So the way we were, so my, the master's degree that I did, so after I did this coaching accreditation program, I went back to my school principal and I said, just so you know, I'm going to be leaving my job at some point because you've sent me on this program. and I ended up doing a master's of science in applied positive psychology and coaching psychology at the University of East London. So the way we speak about positive psychology and coaching is that positive psychology is the theory and it's the research, and coaching is the application. So without coaching, you may not get the benefit of positive psychology, I guess. I mean, you could do it obviously on your own, but a coach is somebody who's going to help you understand and apply the research. Yeah. So there's a field called positive psychology coaching, which is about kind of melding the two of them together. Mm-hmm.
So how did you kind of, I know you've examined a lot of areas related to positive psychology. How was minimalism one of the things that you ended up kind of crossing paths with and digging into?
It's an interesting, I think it's an interesting story. So we had to come up with a dissertation topic, and you could choose whatever you wanted. It just had to be related to well-being and, you know, positive psychology. And I was really struggling. I've got a lot of interest areas. I'm interested in so many different things. And I wanted to come up with some research that I really enjoyed, and that, I guess the other thing, I wanted it to be something a little bit new and fresh. Like, I didn't want to do something that had kind of been done before but doing it in a different way, and I wanted it to be something that I might like to use later in my work. And I remember I was sitting on my bed putting my boots on in London, ready to go to a lecture, and I looked over at my my side table or my bureau, and I had this accumulation. I'd only been in London for maybe no more than 3 months. And I had all of this stuff kind of accumulated on the top of my dresser. And I thought, oh, gosh, how have I accumulated that much stuff already? Like, hairspray. When do I ever use hairspray? Why do I have that, you know? And I was like, oh, that could be a good topic. Minimalism. And I thought, oh, there'll be plenty of research on that already, because there's, you know, so many people, so many podcasts, that, you know, it's such a popular topic. And I started looking, and there was really not a lot of research. And so I thought, well, this is it. This is what I'll do. I'll do some grounded theory research about does minimalism improve well-being? And if so, you know, what are we looking at here? Why are the reasons that it might improve our well-being? So that's how I came up with the idea, basically, because I had accumulated a lot of crap since arriving in London.
Well, I think that's, you know, where we were headed too. Like, as we look around, and I don't feel like we have an overabundance of possessions, but we got a lot of stuff. And so I think it's good to at least raise the question and examine, like, what is our relationship to all these possessions that we have, especially in the modern era where there's so much available for so cheap and it's so accessible. Like the running joke, especially since where we've been at home for so long, is all of the Amazon and, you know, deliveries and mail deliveries that are piling up outside of people's houses. And it's kind of funny to joke about that, but I think it raises a more serious question of, like, just how do we navigate the world of stuff? Is it, you know, to what extent do we want to appropriately use the things around us without it taking on something that kind of becomes a hindrance to our well-being, to the life that we really envision for ourselves.
Yeah. And I think when I started looking into the research, like I said, there wasn't a lot around minimalism or low consumption lifestyles. There's a little bit there, and it's but a lot of it's anecdotal, and a lot of it, the few studies that there are, you know, there's some meaningful links, but like I said, there's not a great deal. But there is a lot of research around materialism, and so materialism is this idea that, you know, possessions are the central focus of the life, and it's the primary means of life satisfaction. You know, I've got my stuff, I've got my house, I've got my possessions. You know, even if you don't think like that, it's this idea, and it is the great, I guess, the great American dream. It's the great Australian dream. Have your house, your car, your boat, maybe. So the research in materialism consistently shows that there is a negative relationship between materialism and life satisfaction. So even though we think that these things make us happy, they just don't. So I think that's probably something that, yeah, that we just don't think about. So there's this idea that lots of reasons why that might be the case. So things like having, I guess, negative self-appraisals and comparing yourself to other people. So the idea of keeping up with the Joneses or the Kardashians, I guess. And I think there's this, I don't want to get too theoretical, but there's a theory.
We're ready.
You cool with that? Yeah. Self-determination theory, where it's basically we want to satisfy these three psychological needs, which are autonomy, competence, and relatedness. And if we don't meet those needs, or if materialists don't meet those needs, they tend to compensate with possessions. But then what happens is they're still not satisfied. They're still not happy. So they continually, I guess, have to purchase more to feel a sense of joy. Because when you do purchase something, you do have that initial buzz and that initial, oh, look, I've got this shiny new object. But it's short-lived. And that's what the research says. It is short-lived. So,
yeah. I like that word for it, the buzz, because that's what we were talking about too. Because when we think of happiness, and it's like, well, you know, when I buy this, it makes me happy. But I think we misunderstand the term, or like maybe better terms like is well-being or fulfillment, right?
Right. It makes you happy for a moment, but it does not give you lasting joy.
Absolutely.
Or purpose or fulfillment.
Yeah. So why do we gravitate so easily towards objects then?
Oh, that's a good question.
Is it just part of the human psyche to see something and want it? My feeling is there's a lot of comparison. Like, have you ever seen someone who had the shiny new object and were like, next day, we're going to get ours?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I think there's that we need these things. I need a new guitar case. Sorry, I'm just looking. You know, I need to be able to carry my guitar more easily, because the one I've got's quite cumbersome and it's difficult to kind of manage and get down the stairs. So I should get a traveling, a soft case that's going to be easier. But, you know, that's another thing that I need. Right. Do I actually need it? You know, is there a real clear defined purpose for it, or is it just going to make my life a little bit easier? So I guess there is that. Some things do make our lives easier, but I guess it's about thinking, do we want an easy life? I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think that's something that we found as we've gotten older too, where like we're questioning like, oh, I want that. And so sometimes I'll put it on like a list, like on my phone or on a piece of paper of like, okay, like my birthday's coming up, and I'll look at this list and I'll actually think about like, do I actually want that? Do I need that? Like, is this many dollars worth? Like, is it meaningful enough to buy this object? And am I going to get a cheap thrill out of it? Right. Looking at it real quick and being happy about it. Or like, does this serve a function or a purpose? And I don't think that I was one, you know, 10 years ago to think about that. It was like, oh, I kind of want that. I have the money. I'll buy it. And I think then it's not until you're a little bit older and maybe like getting rid of those things that you thought you wanted that you realize maybe I need to start thinking about if I really need or want those things.
It almost seems like we need to, like, ask ourselves or distinguish between a need and a want. And then at least if we understand that difference, then we say, oh, I want it. Well, how badly do I want it? And picture the long-term involvement of that item with our life.
So how would you define, is there a definition for like minimalist minimalism? What is the definition?
If I had to define minimalism, I think I defined it in my research as this conscious decision to live with fewer possessions.
Okay.
That's it. That's my minimalism definition.
It would be really long. there
are a lot of extreme minimalists out there. So people who are, you know, sleeping on a sleeping mat on the floor, and they have their 3 black t-shirts and, you know, 1 bar of soap that washes their hair, face, body, clothes, car, you know, that kind of thing. But I think my argument, and I guess that it is, you know, in some of the writings about minimalism, is that it's more about creating and sustaining your own definition of minimalism. So what is minimalism for you? And, you know, I think it's tricky because there are a lot of, you know, bloggers and that out there who, you know, people that I've spoken to have kind of said, oh, I don't really like so-and-so. They seem so pretentious and, you know, I can't possibly live up to that standard of minimalism. I'm like, that's totally the, you know, the wrong way of looking at it. And it shouldn't be making us feel like we're trying, you know, it's almost like materialism again. We're trying to keep up with other people. Mm-hmm. You know, minimalism shouldn't be about trying to be a better minimalist than so-and-so. It should be about, you know, what is it for you? And I think that's how I would like people to define it, you know, to think about what does it mean for me? And it might mean that, you know, when I go shopping, I'm going to really think about what I've already got in my wardrobe, for example, and think about, really consciously think about what I'm buying and whether or not it's going to, you know, go with what I have already, or do I need to remove something to make room for it, or am I going to shop for quality rather than fast fashion and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it's very individual.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we were wondering too. Could, you know, two people with two very different sets of quantities of possessions both, you know, claim to be minimalists? And it seems like the answer would be yes, because it really depends on their perspective towards what they have and maybe even what they had before they make this declaration about themselves.
Definitely. And I think I remember one of the people I interviewed talked about having, she had like 7 pairs of the exact same shoe, you know, in her closet. And she said to me, I was like, oh, that's but for her, they were on sale. This is the type of shoe that she wears and they will last her a lifetime. She will, you know, she will use one set until it falls apart. And then, so I was like, wow, you know, that's actually, and she said, compared to what she used to be like, she would have had, you know, however many pairs, times, you know, whatever. So yeah, it definitely, I think it definitely depends on you and your own definition. It's interesting too, you mentioned about, making the declaration about, you know, being a minimalist. Because there's definitely people who identify as, you know, I'm a minimalist, but I did find when I was reaching out for participants for my research, people would reply and they would say, oh, look, I don't really, like, I wouldn't say I'm a minimalist, but this is my, you know, experience. And yeah, I think it's interesting that, I guess it's kind of like, I don't know what it's like in the States, but here we say you're not really a vegan unless you tell everybody about it, or you're not a CrossFitter unless you tell everyone about it. So I think, you know, I think you could view minimalism, some people view minimalism like that, but yeah, there's definitely people who are living with less that wouldn't, you know, give themselves a label as such.
Do you, have you noticed any generational differences when it comes to minimalists? I just think of like our parents' generation versus us, where
Versus we're in our late 30s, so yeah, I would even say like people, you know, younger, like new adults as well, and you know, 18 to 30.
Yeah, like 18 to 30, and then kind of like 30s and 40s, and even people like 50s, 60s, and 70s. Do you see a difference in their relationship to possessions just based on like the time and the way in which they were raised impacting that?
I haven't looked into it, you know, scientifically. So it's not, this is just more anecdotal. But even speaking to like participants and other people in the research, outside of the research, sorry, there is definitely the older generation seems to keep stuff and want their children to then keep their stuff as well. So
we've noticed that in conversations with, especially my, sorry mom if you're listening.
a lot of my participants had this crippling fear of what's going to happen when their parents die and they have to accumulate all of their stuff. So some of them were really, really, it caused a lot of stress for them, thinking about, I've got to deal with that whole household when they die, and there is so much stuff in there and I don't want any of it. And I think, I don't know, there's this idea that I feel like the older generation have things like, you know, the full case full of crystal and things like that, that the younger generations are just not really interested in. We're not using it as much. And we don't want to just kind of save it for a special occasion. Like it's, we would rather buy stuff that we would use now. So
more functional.
Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. But again, there is, I think, I don't know if it's a generational thing. I know that little kids love their stuff and they'll collect stuff, like rocks and pegs and pieces of paper and string, and it's special to them and they'll hold on to it, and you think, what is all of this junk?
It's like a collection, so your shell collections, what else?
Absolutely. So I think those are probably discussions to have earlier rather than later with kids about stuff. So you know, how important is this? And you know, it's nice to have a memory of you know, your trip to the beach, but, you know, you can have memories without attaching them to things as well. And I think that's why people keep a lot of stuff, because they think, oh, you know, but that reminds me of my trip to so-and-so, or that reminds me of my wedding day, or that reminds me of whatever. But the thing didn't not happen if you don't have the material position to remind you of that.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I was thinking about too, was like that connection of objects to experiences or to memories or to, you know, like eras of one's life. There's a really interesting podcast by Malcolm Gladwell that I was listening to not too long ago, and he does two episodes. He's mostly ranting about art museums, but he kind of gets into hoarders and like various people who, and he talks about that, like there's a kind of emotional connection. There's a story of that they perceive that's maybe more, a little more heightened than the average person when it comes to objects. And they understand and connect their lives and their experiences to objects a little bit more. And then he goes back to like ranting about why art museums collect more than they can ever show. It's really fascinating. I'll forward you the link. Yeah. But you know, that's one thing I was thinking about too, was like, is it different for different people? And you know, one of the questions is like, is minimalism for everybody? Like, does everyone stand to gain from adopting some degree of a minimalist perspective, or is it really going to help, you know, more people or some people more than others?
I've thought about this a bit. And because, you know, when I was doing my research, I was thinking everyone should be doing this. Absolutely. Like, everyone should be living with less. And I was wondering, you know, what, you know, thinking about particular friends and whether or not they would benefit from minimalism. I think there are definite benefits for the average person, no doubt. I think you need to, well, and this kind of came out a little bit in the research as well, is that you need to have some level of autonomy in choosing to live with fewer possessions. So you need to, the benefits would probably only be present if you voluntarily and consciously choose to live that way. So people who are living with fewer possessions because they're living in poverty or, you know, in a developing nation or something, they may not benefit from minimalism the way that we would. But that being said, people in lower socioeconomic, you know, areas or developing nations, they are still subject to the same kind of consumer messages that we are. So they will still see, you know, the famous basketball player with the brand new, you know, Nikes or whatever. And they're still bombarded with those messages. So I think that there is benefit possibly to thinking about how the attitudes that minimalists have towards consumerism could possibly provide some well-being benefits to those people, because that's not, I mean, my research, everyone was middle class, Western, and yeah, they saw very clear benefits to living with less, but it was definitely a conscious choice for them.
Yeah, in your research, you reference how a lot of the people that you spoke with and have read about in other research, like, we're talking about definitely like physical objects in a physical space, but that connected to the mental space that they seemed to experience along with those objects. Can you talk about the relationship between the physical and the mental when it comes to possessions?
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, so the idea was that your mental space, what's happening in your physical space reflects what's happening in your mental space and vice versa. So if you're living in a cluttered, chaotic home, that's the cause and the result of kind of having a cluttered and chaotic mind, if that makes sense. So the participants kind of said that minimalism provided the means to create space both in their mental world and in their physical world. So, yeah, and this idea of mental energy as well. So they had fewer choices to make, for example, about what clothes they were going to wear that day, so they didn't have to use the mental energy to, you know, to think about that kind of stuff in the morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it is really interesting, the idea of mental space and physical space. I think the idea that making space for what matters is a bit of a catchphrase comes to minimalism, minimalist blog, whatnot. And this was one of the things that didn't pop up much in the research about that I had looked at previously. So, yeah, I think there is a bit of a discussion about clutter in homes and in schools and how that can affect your performance and increase your stress because of the attention it takes away from, you know, what you're doing. So right now, like, you know, you wouldn't believe my desk at the moment. Like, it's not particularly minimalist currently. I've got kind of projects balanced all over the shop. So but, you know, I always know that if I want to get something done, I completely clear my desk and I have my laptop and whatever I'm working on because I know that then my focus is there.
Mm. Yeah, I've experienced that too, just professionally. Like, if I really want to focus on something, then, you know, getting rid of the items, the more organized things are, making sure the clutter's off my desk. I found that that's harder digitally though, because you know, email inboxes are always bouncing. There's always like tabs open on my screen. I have little files that I'm working on my desktop. And I found that that's been just as much, if not more so. Like, I feel like cluttering some of the mental space. So if I want to focus, and I'm working on the very screen that a lot of this is going on at the same time, it's difficult to parse through those.
Yeah, I found myself clearing my desktop where I've got like files just kind of saved when you don't want to put them away, and feeling like you're like putting all of your clothes in your laundry away and hanging them up and making your bed before you can like sit down.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
And how good does it feel when it's...
Oh, feels so good.
Yeah.
Right, you've already crossed one thing off your list by taking care of it. I'm interested if you saw any connections with, because you said you used to work in a school, and so you kind of understand probably kids to a pretty good degree. We have kids. And we were talking about, you know, as kids, they're advertised and bombarded with things and stuff by advertisers and by friends and what the latest trend is. And as parents, sometimes we recognize, like, they say they want this object or this thing because somebody else has it or they think it's going to make them happy. But knowing our kids and their likes and what they actually use, we sometimes try and dissuade them from putting certain items on their wish list or their birthday list or whatever.
Oh, Santa forgot it.
Yeah, oh, yeah. But look what we did get you, this really great creative tool. You should really use it. Is that a good thing? Like, we try and talk to our kids about that, like the comparison of these friends have these items and maybe the reasons why we don't, kind of leading them through the thinking of we're intentional about what we're choosing for you or even what you're choosing for yourself. You know, is that a good thing to do? Or as children, do we give them the freedom to make those choices and figure it out?
No, I think it's a great thing to do. I don't have children, but I do work with them. So I think it is really important for kids to be thinking about this stuff and to be thinking about where their stuff comes from. So I know at least one of my participants was talking about how she wouldn't think twice about buying what she would call a plastic piece of junk for her child if they wanted it. If they were somewhere and they were like, "Mommy, I want this," she wouldn't even think twice about it. And since, you know, consciously making this decision to live with less, she now thinks, where did that come from? Where is it going to end up, more importantly? Because this is not something that this child is going to treasure and keep forever. So I think it is really important to have those discussions with kids and for them to realize that real happiness does not come from these things. It comes from, you know, Christmas morning, for example, sitting around and opening the presents is more likely to be remembered by them than what they actually got. So yeah, I think that there is research around experiences bringing far more joy and meaning to somebody's life than possessions. So definitely.
Well, that's what we wanted to get into as well is, I mean, because that's one thing that we've tried to do is make that shift, like, especially with like kids' gifts, but more so just in how we operate as a family, like shifting, not completely away, but like within reason, shifting away from purchases of items and trying to make memories and experiences. So is that, I mean, our assumption with that is that like we'll cherish a memory and a unique experience a lot more than, you know, some item that we buy, use a little bit, and then eventually throw away. But are you saying like that is true? Like that's going to pan out over time, that the experiences are definitely the thing to pursue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even, I mean, think back to your own childhood without getting too deep. But, you know, what are the things that stand out? So for me, memories of being on our boat with the family, we used to, you know, spend a lot of time on an island. And I, you know, we had nothing, we took a pack of cards when we went to the island. That was our, you know, our only entertainment besides climbing rocks and snorkeling and, you know, playing on the beach. So, you know, when I think back to my childhood, what I remember is 100% the experiences. You know, with the exception of the time that my brothers bought me rollerblades when my parents wouldn't. But again, the memory of that is then that I used to go rollerblading with my older brother all the time. And so it was the experience of that I think probably made that the most memorable gift. that I ever received.
Well, it's not even that it's about like not spending money or not buying objects, but you know, we're talking about one of our son's birthday is coming up and buying a basketball hoop for out front. And it's an expensive gift. That's more expensive than, you know, a bunch of cheap plastic toys that he'll get sick of. But the idea is then we would all be out front as a family around that hoop playing. His friends would come over. So it's all about those things that are tied with
like
it.
The object grants you access to the experience.
Right. Like a boat. Yeah. Like a boat is not cheap, but the boat allowed for your family to be together, to play cards, and to have those experiences.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, one thing I thought about too is, and I've talked to Rosanna about this, because, you know, when you have kids, they're, you know, opening up gifts. And a lot of the time I feel like it's more for the adults to like to see that little jolt of excitement, like, oh, you bought me this. But I felt bad, especially when they're really little. Like, first of all, they're more interested in the box than what's inside of it. But then, you know, even if they are excited to say like, oh, it's a truck. Then our next thing is to like take it away and put it to the side and say like, you cannot use this right now because you have, you know, X number more gifts to open. And I always, like, that always made me cringe a little bit, just because it's, I just don't know. I just didn't feel like it was what they wanted, or the right thing to show that we're just going to, you know, inundate them with items right now. But we have tried to get away from even gifts too. And like ask family and friends like for big occasions to buy the kids, or even for us, you know, when someone asks like, let's get access to an experience, some place that we can go or something that we can do where a memory could be made. And I've enjoyed that. We've also asked like, how about just money for like a college fund? That would be great too. Not many takers on that. So I think there's definitely something to be said about those experiences. Cause I feel like personally, those are the things that it seems like we end up cherishing, are the memories and the values and connections that we make through them.
Definitely. Definitely. I think you've kind of hit on an interesting point there about, extended family. So, and like I said, with the, you know, participants in my study did fear what they were going to inherit, I guess, but they also spoke a lot about struggling to explain this decision to their family, and grandparents particularly wanting to continually give their child stuff that they didn't want their child to have. Mm-hmm. Or you know, palm off stuff onto them, like, oh, I've got this beautiful vase that you should have in your house. I'm like, well, I don't want that vase in my house, but really struggling to kind of, you know, politely decline those kind of things. So that is, I don't, you know, minimalism does come with, I guess, you know, this dark side of possible, not disadvantages, but things to consider. So there is this idea, you know, the idea of the taking on other people's stuff. I know that a lot of the people that I spoke to really struggled with clutter. So, you know, clutter would make them physically, you know, anxious. And that was a really tricky thing for them. And there was another, what's the other thing? Completely lost it. Oh, this a lot of minimalists really struggle with making a quick decision about a purchase, for example. And not saying that they should make a quick decision, but they would painstakingly research all of their options before they would make a decision, and that can be stressful as well. So say if something like a laptop they've got to buy, they would be really, you know, really researching every last kind of possible combination of things.
Yeah, I remember reading that in your paper that, I could totally see that. It's like when you're at a restaurant and you have a great menu, but you can only get one item. We can spend a lot of time like looking through that. And it's that whole, I think the paradox of choice of, you know, you think more choices would make you happier, but it's totally stressful, especially if you're going to try to limit yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's talk about like consuming. So let's say we're at the store And not that we've been to many stores lately, but when we do go with our masks on and we're distanced from everybody, or more likely like on Amazon or online shopping somewhere nowadays. But we're considering a purchase. What kind of thought process would go into a consumer decision for someone who is trying to be more minimalistic?
I would say, do I need this, first of all? Do I have something that already does this is another question, because I feel like that's something that we do a lot. We will buy things that we've already got something that would do the same thing. For me, an important thing is where will this end up? So,
do you mean like, will it end up in the garbage, thrown away?
Yeah. Will it end up in the garbage? I think something like, oh, I looked it up, 85% of our clothes end up in landfill. So in the US, it's something like 25 billion tons per year of textile waste. Like, that's a lot of stuff.
All right, side question. So let's say someone had a hole in one of his socks. Now, in theory, 99% of the sock is still pretty good.
90%, the hole is big. Maybe 90% of the sock is still good.
Also, this isn't a hypothetical.
This is many a discussion.
But we've talked about, like, he's like, well, most of it still works. I said, right, but there's nothing wrong with replacing something that's broken or unusable. It's, you know.
Maybe. I don't know. But that's one of the discussions that we had.
And this is where your own definition of minimalism, I think, is important. So I know people who would patch the sock, and I know other people who would say, that sock is done. Or repurpose it into a sock pocket, pop it, or you know, that kind of thing. So that's an interesting thing that popped up about the idea that being a minimalist makes you feel more competent, because you're doing things, you are repurposing and fixing and trying to make the most of items that you do have before getting rid of them. So that gives you kind of a boost of, oh, you know, I managed to fix this where, you know, last year I would have just thrown it out. So yeah, there's that idea as well.
Have you heard this idea of people doing like a no buy year? So like in a life of abundance, it's a notion of doing with what you have. So like, you know, you would buy groceries and you would buy toilet paper, things that you run out of or you consume, but saying like making that conscious decision, I'm not going to buy clothes unless for some reason they no longer fit or there's a hole or something, and sticking to like what the necessities truly are.
Mm.
And what do you think of that?
I think I bow down to these people. I think that's an incredible experiment. I've not done it. I think I should, to be honest. I think it's something that I would be really interested in. And I mean, so things that I tend to spend my money on when I, you know, I was getting my tax ready yesterday and I'm looking at kind of the resources and the things that I've purchased over the past year, and I added up and I'm like, holy dooly, like that's a lot of, you know, reference books and, you know, things like that. So, yeah, I think I think in the probably the first, you know, 3 to 6 months would be when you really realize how much stuff you buy that you don't need. So, you know, even just that conscious kind of, you know, you would be in a store and you would be grocery shopping and you'd be like, oh, I might just grab that. Oh no, hang on, I can't actually purchase that. Wow. And then I think you would do that a lot before you realize I make more unnecessary purchases than I thought. So yeah. There is a lot of blogs and stuff about it. I think I find it fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear about that until today when you brought that up.
You were today years old.
Yeah. It sounds like a great idea for someone who wants to intentionally spend. Well, I like the idea that it's for a year too, if that's the way like people are orchestrating it. So it's like, I don't have to live this way forever, but at least for this amount of time, I'll choose to live in this.
It comes from the type of person who is looking at intentionality of their life and what they're doing with their resources and how to better use their resources. And so one of the people that brought this to my attention was to live more frugally within her means, because she realized she was spending excess, so that she could do more with what she had for others and for herself through bigger experiences, or even building into her own business that she started, that it was going to free up funds to let her put it back into the business to grow.
Probably save a lot of money.
Yeah. So it was just an interesting take on that. The other notion that I've seen come to light more frequently, and friends of others are doing this, where they're basically kind of selling homes and possessions and getting an RV and committing to living in an RV for a year or two, seeking experiences, touring the country, seeing and living life, and letting go of the stuff. Which,
this is my dream.
That's your dream. This is not my dream. And so I love hearing about it, and like I want to know more about it. But the thought of that even scares me a little bit, because that seems it seems extreme. But for a lot of people, it is not.
Well, I think it does seem extreme. I think having a home makes people feel safe and secure. You know, you've got a base, and that's where you are. Whereas if you've got a van, sorry, I'm in Australia, there's bugs flying around. when you're in a van, it feels a lot more temporary. So that does cause that kind of feeling of uncertainty. But for some people, that is a feeling of excitement and adventure. So,
mm-hmm. I think very free.
I think the way I try to keep my possessions is in preparation for when I will live in a van, or a tiny home is another, and that's another movement where a shipping container kind of home where you can't have so many possessions in there.
Right. So let's say someone is, listening to this or just otherwise inspired to think a little bit more about decluttering and about taking on a more minimalist lifestyle. What are some first steps you would recommend that person take?
In way of things like resources or, books and whatnot to read, or...
I want to talk about that. So both, like, if someone is like, all right, I'm a minimalist now, what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the first action points? Maybe just the first things to think about before they really dive into it. And then if they want to learn more, like, do you have any recommendations for other resources?
I think talking to other people who have experienced it, have become a minimalist or are trying to live with less, I think that's a really good way to start, because they are the most kind of passionate and excited about it. So and they'll tell you the truth about the things that are difficult, like the family stuff and that kind of thing. Starting to take stock of what you have, and I think a kind of a cull initially is a great idea. So to kind of think about what you have, and it's not, you don't necessarily have to get rid of some stuff, but maybe even the idea of putting it somewhere for a year and seeing if you use it in that year. And if you don't use it in that year, what are the chances of you using it in the next year? I think that's a really good way to start. In terms of resources, like the first book I ever read years and years ago was The Joy of Less by Francine Jay, I think her last name is. And to me, it was just like ding, 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 like light bulbs going off. It was... And I think the message from that book that I still think about and use this as an example is the idea of memories and possessions. So, she was the one that made me think about if you don't – wedding dresses are a prime example. I don't have one, but I know a lot of women keep their wedding dress. Mm-hmm. If you don't have your wedding dress, it doesn't mean you didn't get married or have a wedding day. You've probably got hundreds of beautiful photos that will, you know, that help you to remember what the dress looked like. And every time you see the dress, wherever it is, it probably makes you feel guilty about how much space it's taking up, or, you know, what you could be doing with that instead. So I guess that's another thing to think about is, you know, if you've got something that you're keeping, maybe it does bring you a great deal of joy, and every anniversary you put it on and remember, well, that's great. But I know that most people are probably not doing that and are probably feeling guilty when they, you know, when they see it and the space that it takes up. So those kind of things to consider. There's lots of podcasts and blogs. I know the Minimalists have a Netflix documentary, and, you know, they write really interesting essays and have a podcast. And Joshua Becker is another one that I really like. He's called Becoming Minimalist. And he talks a lot about minimalism and kids and stuff like that as well. So, yeah.
We just did a 1-year test. So we moved into our current home about a year ago, and there was a box of stuff in the basement, and it was like a big box that, like, when we unpacked, it was kind of like, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this. Do we keep it? Do we not? So we said, all right, it's in the basement. We don't see it. We don't look at it. If after a year,
we haven't used it, we can't think of when we're going to use it.
Right. So we just purged a whole bunch of stuff that we thought, all right, if we haven't used it, it's taken up space, we don't need it. And kind of just let that, like, looked at it as a memory and kind of, you know, had that moment of reminiscing and then said goodbye.
Let it go.
And then, well, that's another thing that people, like a strategy that people have come up with, because we live in such a digital world. If you've got something that's physical, but you're like, oh, I don't really want this, but I don't want to forget that I had it, take a photo of it. You've still got the photo, you know, and then you can get rid of the thing. But I guess the other thing is, it's not just about getting rid of stuff as well, because, you know, we don't want to just have stuff in landfill. So the most important thing is about bringing less in to your home as the most important kind of starting factor. So don't worry too much about what you have. And if you can, you know, repurpose or recycle, re-gift it, you know, one man's trash, another man's treasure kind of thing. So just because you don't have a use for it anymore doesn't mean that somebody else hasn't been dying to find one of those. So,
yeah. Well, we're coming up towards the tail end of our conversation. Can you tell us if someone is interested in connecting with you or learning more about you and your work and positive psychology, where can they go?
Well, they could go to my website, which is caseylloyd.com, or, you know, follow me on social. So I'm on Facebook and Instagram, and it's at Coach Casey Lloyd. You know, I'm not the best social media poster. I try and minimize that a little bit. I'm going to try and get a little bit more active on there. But, yeah, feel free. They can reach out. And I love talking about this stuff. And, you know, interested in coaching people around this kind of thing, because I know it is a tricky thing to do, especially if you're struggling to, you know, make the initial kind of step into living with less. I do have a little bit of an idea for a online course soon. Actually, if I show you my window, that's my planning for my online course up on the window, all my post-it notes. So, yeah, there's that. That possibly could be coming, so maybe keep an eye out for that.
Awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, I think we've learned a lot, and that's part of our, you know, just even our desire in hosting a podcast is the excuse to have good conversations with one another and with knowledgeable people like yourself. And so it gives us a lot to just continue to, you know, just digest and reassess really, you know, how we're doing with things and making sure we've like in our shared taglines, making life worth living.
Yeah. I like this idea of it being connected to well-being and fulfillment and sustainability and joy, like things that
there's not words we talk about enough. Like, we talk about happiness a lot, but I like those words better.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, happiness is an emotion, so it's fleeting.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you can't always feel happy, but you can always have meaning, or you can, you know, have purpose. And so, yeah, there's definitely more scope to talk about that kind of stuff for sure.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Casey. It was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we hope you enjoyed our interview with Casey Lloyd as much as we did. I felt like it was a privilege to be able to speak to an expert who gave us, I think, a great deal more understanding and helped us articulate maybe some of the inclinations and feelings that we've had about minimalism over the years.
Yeah, just getting a definition of it, a working definition, seeing how it applies in different areas of buying and purchasing and health and happiness. I think that's a good way to help understand it in terms of our own lives.
Yeah. So we were taking a lot of notes as we were going. In fact, I was impressed. Maybe it's just my handwriting is smaller, but Rosanna wrote some significant amount of notes all over our papers here. And we were just learning a whole bunch from Casey. So we had a few takeaways that we just wanted to dialogue through a little bit. And maybe there's even some more beyond that that you enjoyed from the conversation as well. And we'd like to hear what impacted you. So the first thing I wanted to bring up was something that she mentioned, and we explored this a little bit during our conversation, is that I think we can be misled a little bit when we tell ourselves that we are pursuing happiness. And I know that's this core American phrase, the pursuit of happiness. But I think there's this interesting contrast between happiness and fulfillment, or happiness and well-being. And it seemed like happiness can be this feeling that we have, but it can be a very fleeting feeling. And we keep finding somewhat fleeting experiences, like the purchase of an object, to give us that little happiness spike. But it goes away almost as quickly as it arrives. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it doesn't do anything for any kind of long-term well-being. It's like, ooh, new shoes,
mm-hmm.
You know, add them to the cart. They get delivered. You put them on. You know, they're fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, a couple days, a couple weeks later, it kind of wears itself out.
Right. Once the newness wears off, so too does the feeling that came with that newness. Whereas maybe something more meaningful to pursue is fulfillment or well-being. And those are certainly terms that I'm going to be considering much more consistently now. But just for the sake of wondering, like, okay, if I am going to buy something, or if I am going to add this object to my life in this way, In what manner will it end up impacting my well-being? And maybe it is a practical item. And I, you know, I'm of course not like totally anti-consumerism.
Yeah, I was going to say we still need toilet paper and hand soap and, you know, toothpaste. Right. We need those things.
Right. So there's a practicality to our consumer choices. But I think the bigger picture is just looking at the way we live and the things, whether they're objects or experiences or relationships. So you're just about, you know, fill in the blank with anything that we put in our lives. To what extent is that helping us pursue a feeling that really matters? And I wouldn't say happiness is that feeling. I would say this contentment or this well-being. And sometimes it's fewer objects. Sometimes it's fewer things that we're being inundated with that would increase our feeling of fulfillment.
So just taking on more objects is not necessarily going to fulfill us.
Right. And could even have the opposite impact.
Gotcha.
And so that really hit me. And another thing that stood out too, because I felt this, but never really articulated it this way, was when she talked about our physical objects not only occupying a physical space, but also occupying a mental space. And so the more objects we have, the more mental space is allocated towards, you know, I don't even...
Organizing, arranging.
Like, yeah, and just like understanding those objects. And the more cluttered our life was, then the more cluttered our mind was as well. So there is a lot of value in kind of stripping down the objects, being organized, getting rid of what you don't need, because that increases our mental well-being and increases maybe even the fulfillment and joy from the objects that we have, because we have more mental and emotional space for experiencing those things.
Well, and that just reminds me of like when I sit down at my desk to work. You ever like sit down at your desk and there's just like stuff strewn? It's like the stuff that you don't want to deal with, the stuff you have to deal with. Mm-hmm. Before I can ever work, like I have to like clear all that out.
Right.
Like, and then I feel lighter. It's like, okay, I've got a pile for the garbage, a pile for the recycle.
If I can everything is organize like, it onto a to-do list. And right.
Right. And then it's just like, I feel like I'm able to work. It's like, I need to get rid of that before I can then have the like mental space to like create something or start something.
Right. And so that it takes away even from our creativity and our productivity because we're spending so much time just organizing the stuff that we have. You know, I feel this way even with digital objects as well. And I don't know if how, you know, how much this intersects with minimalism, but I think of feeling cluttered with my electronic documents or with my emails. And right, we've had these conversations. You laugh at me because I have to clear out the inbox and it just drives me nuts. But now I understand what that's doing. I feel like it's occupying a certain capacity of my mental space. And I want to clear it out so I can feel like I can more focusedly work on what I need to.
Yeah. Well, and I think both of those things, talking about happiness versus well-being and then mental space and physical space, all gets to the root of one of the words that we always talk about, and that's intentionality. Mm-hmm. So I think that if there's some application for this, there's some questions that we should ask ourselves in terms of what are our intentions when we're buying objects? So I think some of the things that we can ask ourselves is, are we cognizant of the relationship we have with obtaining objects? Like, mm-hmm. why are we buying those objects? And I will be completely honest, like, there are times like when I feel like things are like out of control or I feel down or something, like I want to buy something because mm-hmm. like all of a sudden it makes me feel happy for that moment, mm-hmm. but I'm not considering like long-term, like what am I doing with this? Like sometimes even just buying those things feels good at the moment. But then when you look at your debit account or your credit card bill and you're thinking, shouldn't have done that, you know, where it's like, what? I'm going to feel good now, but when I get the bill later, I'm going to feel horrible.
Right.
So it's like that intentionality, like, what is the relationship? Like, why am I buying this? Like, mm-hmm. am I doing this because I feel bad about something or I feel bogged down? And so like, I'm trying to like,
or is there a practical necessity or, you know, something,
do I
if you're buying
this?
Something of quality that will last. Right. So are you suggesting then that when we're making our purchases, whatever they are, that there's kind of a pre-purchase process of just questioning and assessing what in the world we're doing before we're choosing to bring those things into our life.
Yeah. And not just purchasing like on the spot or on the fly. I am, and I know a lot of people are like this, like I add things to my cart often and yeah. then I'll let them sit there. Like, so I get the thrill of shopping, but mm-hmm. I never really check out right away because I continue to consider that purchase. And then I consider that purchase against like maybe like the kids need shoes for back to school. So like, do I really need this because we're going to be spending money on that? So it's like, I kind of weigh those options. And so sometimes I look at them in my cart and drool over them. And I'm like, mm-hmm. you know what? If 2 weeks from now, like I still really think I need those or want those, or I've earned those because I've worked extra hours, then mm-hmm. I will purchase that. But I'm thinking more about, do I really need it?
Yeah. That's
do I need it or do I want
thoughtful.
It?
Thoughtful. That's my tattoo rule. Because if you want a tattoo, I don't know what the number of years I've said, like maybe 2 or 3 years. If you want the same tattoo 2 or 3 years from now, then it's okay to go get it.
And you told me that when I was 30 and I was considering a tattoo and I am now 37 and still do not have a tattoo because I can't think of one thing that I want now that I may want like 3 years from now on my body. So
right.
No tattoos for me.
You don't want my face on your back or anything?
No, I love you, but I don't want that on my back. So that was the first question. Like, what's the relationship we have with obtaining the object? What's the reason why? What's the purpose? And mm-hmm. then even just thinking about, does a large portion of our life revolve around tangible things?
Right.
Like, am I a person who wants stuff for the sake of stuff? Like,
well, to an extent, yeah,
yes.
We all are, right?
But how do I just be more intentional about, is that the kind of person I want to be? Someone who just collects items.
So it's almost assessing your values first. Like, here's what I really want to be pursuing in life. Are these objects going to be anywhere near that?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, just thinking about that, like asking yourselves those questions, like if we're fixated on the stuff, I think this just kind of sums up what you just put into words for me. How do we have room for our values, our visions, and meanings that are bigger and deeper than the things we aspire to buy?
Wow. So what you aspire to buy could even get in the way of your values.
Right.
If it's cluttering your physical and your mental space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the one
stakes are high.
I know this is getting really deep. And then the second question, that application, and this is something that Casey spoke about, and it was, where are these things going to end up that we buy?
I thought that was a really interesting question.
And, you know, I'm going to go back to like her thing with the kids. Like, you know, we can say yes to like these little plasticky junky toys for the kids, but we all know where those are ending up, Mom. The minute they turn around, like after a birthday party and after all that stuff, like we throw them away. So it's like, why would I spend money on an object that I know that I'm just going to throw away, or that's going to clutter a landfill and clog up the environment? Like, are we really thinking through where this is going to end up?
Yeah. I think that's a thoughtful question, because there's kind of three phases to the object. There's the one like before we have it. There's a time while we have it. And then at some point where we're not going to have that object. And it might be, you know, when we die and pass
it on. We're not going to have the object. Some people will keep it
somebody
forever.
Somebody else might have it. Or we may choose to, you know, just, you know, get rid of it by selling it or giving it away or throwing it away at some point too. So I think that's an important question to ask. But even while you have it, is this just going to end up being in a drawer? Is this just going to end up, you know, like taking up unnecessary space that I could use for, you know, some better purpose? And then eventually, like, what is the final destination of this object? And when you picture it at its final destination, I think that adds a little bit more perspective of its current involvement in your life too. Kind of like when you picture your own, you know, not to be morbid, but you picture your own like final destination.
Wow.
Right. It gives perspective to the time that you do have. So maybe that's, you know, I won't always have this object, but now during the time that it is in my life, what is the role that it plays?
Yeah. You won't. What is that? It's kind of a joke, like a morbid joke. Like, you can't take it with you. Like,
right.
So what are you going to do with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think those are just, you know, what is your relationship to objects? You know, what portion of your life revolves around those things, those handbags, those, you know, jewelry, clothing, shoes, whatever it is. And then where are these things actually going to end up?
Exactly.
And that might sway you from buying things that you don't need. So it's all about the intentionality, I think, in front of it and the thoughtfulness going into a purchase.
That's good. So there's a lot of questions that we can continue to ask ourselves. And I think for us, we're going to evaluate, and it just seems like an ongoing process, right? Like, we're going to reevaluate our relationship to the objects that we have as time goes on as well, to make sure that we may never call ourselves minimalists per se, but at least asking the right questions may help us lead a more fulfilling life.
Right. Even though I like to shop and add things to my cart.
Right. All right. So we strongly encourage you to check out the show notes where we'll provide links for everything that you heard us enjoy talking about today. And we also strongly encourage you to find Casey Lloyd, and she's doing some incredible work. And I think that you all will learn a lot more from her.
Well, this wraps up season 2, episode 3, and we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much for listening to today's show. We hope you will use this conversation as a starting point for your own. We hope you're encouraged to think and act more intentionally.
If you want to learn more, you can visit our website, therelentlesspursuitpodcast.com, where you can find notes on today's show, plus additional blog posts, and you can subscribe to our free members list.
Please subscribe, leave a review, and share with your friends.
Facebook and Instagram are two great places to connect with us for daily doses of our quotable quotes, behind the scenes, and real-time photos, videos, and challenges.
Until next time, let us know how you are taking life off autopilot
and relentlessly pursuing what matters.